Chapter 3. Not to disparage myself, said he, by the comparison with such a rascal, what art thou, but a vagabond without house or home, without stock or inheritance? Born to no possession of your own, but a pair of wings and a drone pipe. Your livelihood is a universal plunder upon nature, a freebooter over fields and gardens, and, for the sake of stealing, will rob a nettle as easily as a violet. Whereas I am a domestic animal, furnished with a native stock within myself. This large castle, to show my improvements in the mathematics, is all built with my own hands, and the materials extracted altogether out of my own person. I am glad, answered the bee, to hear you grant at least, that I am come honestly by my wings and my voice. For then, it seems, I am obliged to heaven alone for my flights and my music, and Providence would never have bestowed on me two such gifts without designing them for the noblest ends. I visit, indeed, all the flowers and blossoms of the field and garden, but whatever I collect thence enriches myself without the least injury to their beauty, their smell, or their taste. Now, for you and your skill in architecture and other mathematics, I have little to say. In that building of yours there might, for aught I know, have been labor and method enough, but, by woeful experience for us both, it is too plain the materials are not, and I hope you will henceforth take warning, and consider duration and matter, as well as method and art. You boast, indeed, of being obliged to no other creature, but of drawing and spinning out all from yourself. That is to say, if we may judge of the liquor in the vessel by what issues out, you possess a good plentiful store of dirt and poison in your breast, and, though I would by no means lessen, or disparage your genuine stock of either, yet I doubt you are somewhat obliged, for an increase of both, to a little foreign assistance. Your inherent portion of dirt does not fall of acquisitions, by sweepings exhaled from below, and one insect furnishes you with a share of poison to destroy another. So that, in short, the question comes all to this. Whether is the nobler being of the two, that which, by a lazy contemplation of 4 inches round, by an overweening pride, feeding, and engendering on itself, turns all into excrement and venom, producing nothing at all but flybane and a cobweb, or that which, by a universal range, with long search, much study, true judgment, and distinction of things, brings home honey and wax. This dispute was managed with such eagerness, clamor, and warmth, that the two parties of books, in arms below, stood silent a while, waiting in suspense what would be the issue, which was not long undetermined. For the bee, grown impatient at so much loss of time, fled straight away to a bed of roses, without looking for a reply, and left the spider, like an orator, collected in himself, and just prepared to burst out. It happened upon this emergency, that Aesop broke silence first. He had been of late most barbarously treated by a strange effect of the regent's humanity, who had torn off his title page, sorely defaced one half of his leaves, and chained him fast among a shelf of moderns, where, soon discovering how high the quarrel was likely to proceed, he tried all his arts, and turned himself to a thousand forms. At length, in the borrowed shape of an ass, the regent mistook him for a modern, by which means he had time and opportunity to escape to the ancients, just when the spider and the bee were entering into their contest, to which he gave his attention with a world of pleasure, and, when it was ended, swore in the loudest key that in all his life he had never known two cases so parallel and adapt to each other as that in the window and this upon the shelves. He disputants, said he, have admirably managed the dispute between them, have taken in the full strength of all that is to be said on both sides, and exhausted the substance of every argument pro and con. It is but to adjust the reasonings of both to the present quarrel, then to compare and apply the labors and fruits of each, as the bee has learnedly deduced them, and we shall find the conclusion fall plain, and close upon the moderns and us. For pray, gentlemen, Was ever anything so modern as the spider in his air, his turns, and his paradoxes? He argues in the behalf of you, his brethren, and himself, with many boastings of his native stock and great genius, that he spins, and spits wholly from himself, and scorns to own any obligation or assistance from without. Then he displays to you his great skill in architecture and improvement in the mathematics. To all this the bee, as an advocate retained by us, the ancients, thinks fit to answer, that, if one may judge of the great genius or inventions of the moderns by what they have produced, you will hardly have countenance to bear you out in boasting of either. Erect your schemes with as much method and skill as you please. Yet, if the materials be nothing but dirt, spun out of your own entrails the guts of modern brains, the edifice will conclude at last in a cobweb, the duration of which, like that of other spiders' webs, may be imputed to their being forgotten, or neglected, or hid in a corner. For anything else of genuine, that the moderns may pretend to, I cannot recollect. Unless it be a large vein of wrangling and satire, much of a nature and substance with the spider's poison, which, however they pretend to spit wholly out of themselves, is improved by the same arts, by feeding upon the insects and vermin of the age. As for us, the ancients, we are content with the bee, to pretend to nothing of our own beyond our wings and our voice. That is to say, our flights and our language. For the rest, whatever we have got, has been by infinite labor and search, and ranging through every corner of nature. The difference is, that, instead of dirt and poison, we have rather chosen to till our hives with honey and wax, thus furnishing mankind with the two noblest of things, which are sweetness and light. It is wonderful to conceive the tumult arisen among the books upon the close of this long descant of Aesop. Both parties took the hint, and heightened their animosity so on a sudden, that they resolved it should come to a battle. Immediately the two main bodies withdrew, under their several ensigns, to the farther parts of the library, and there entered into cabals, and consults upon the present emergency. The moderns were in very warm debates upon the choice of their leaders, and nothing less than the fear impending from their enemies, could have kept them from mutinies upon this occasion. The difference was greatest among the horse, where every private trooper pretended to the chief command, from Tasso and Milton to Dryden and Wither. The light horse were commanded by Cowley and Despreaux. There came the bowmen under their valiant leaders, Descartes, Gassendi, and Hobbes, whose strength was such that they could shoot their arrows beyond the atmosphere, never to fall down again, but turn, like that of Evander, into meteors, or, like the cannonball, into stars. Paracelsus brought a squadron of stinkpot flingers from the snowy mountains of Rhaetia. There came a vast body of dragoons, of different nations, under the leading of Harvey, their great aga. Part armed with scythes, the weapons of death, part with lances and long knives, all steeped in poison, part shot bullets of a most malignant nature, and used white powder, which infallibly killed without report. There came several bodies of heavy armed foot, all mercenaries, under the ensigns of Cixiardini, Davila, Polydor, Virgil, Buchanan, Mariana, Camden, and others. The engineers were commanded by Regiomontanus and Wilkins. The rest was a confused multitude, led by Scotus, Aquinas, and Bellarmine, of mighty bulk and stature, but without either arms, courage, or discipline. In the last place came infinite swarms of Calans, a disorderly rout led by Lestrange, rogues and ragamuffins, that follow the camp for nothing but the plunder, all without coats to cover them. The army of the ancients was much fewer in number. Homer led the horse, and Pindar the light horse. Euclid was chief engineer, Plato and Aristotle commanded the bowmen, Herodotus and Livy the foot, Hippocrates, the dragoons, the allies, led by Vossius and Temple, brought up the rear. All things violently tending to a decisive battle, Fame, who much frequented, and had a large apartment formerly assigned her in the regal library, fled up straight to Jupiter, to whom she delivered a faithful account of all that passed between the two parties below, for among the gods she always tells truth. Jove, in great concern, convokes a council in the Milky Way. The Senate assembled, he declares the occasion of convening them, a bloody battle just impendent between two mighty armies of ancient and modern creatures, called books, wherein the celestial interest was but too deeply concerned. Momus, the patron of the moderns, made an excellent speech in their favor, which was answered by Pallas, the protectress of the ancients. The assembly was divided in their affections, when Jupiter commanded the Book of Fate to be laid before him. Immediately were brought by Mercury three large volumes in folio, containing memoirs of all things past, present, and to come. The clasps were of silver double gilt, the covers of celestial turkey leather, and the paper such as here on Earth might pass almost for vellum. Jupiter, having silently read the decree, would communicate the import to none, but presently shut up the book. Without the doors of this assembly there attended a vast number of light, nimble gods, menial servants to Jupiter. Those are his ministering instruments in all affairs below. They travel in a caravan, more or less together, and are fastened to each other like a link of galley slaves, by a light chain, which passes from them to Jupiter's great toe. And yet, in receiving or delivering a message, they may never approach above the lowest step of his throne, where he and they whisper to each other through a large hollow trunk. These deities are called by mortal men accidents or events, but the gods call them second causes. Jupiter having delivered his message to a certain number of these divinities, they flew immediately down to the pinnacle of the regal library, and consulting a few minutes, entered unseen, and disposed the parties according to their orders. Meanwhile Momus, fearing the worst, and calling to mind an ancient prophecy which bore no very good face to his children the moderns, bent his flight to the region of a malignant deity called Criticism. She dwelt on the top of a snowy mountain in Nova Zembla. There Momus found her extended in her den, upon the spoils of numberless volumes, half devoured. At her right hand sat Ignorance, her father and husband, blind with age. At her left, Pride, her mother, dressing her up in the scraps of paper herself had torn. There was Opinion, her sister, light of foot, hood-winked, and headstrong, yet giddy and perpetually turning. About her played her children, Noise, and Impudence, Dullness, and Vanity, Positiveness, Pedantry, and Ill Manners. The goddess herself had claws like a cat. Her head, and ears, and voice resembled those of an ass. Her teeth fallen out before, her eyes turned inward, as if she looked only upon herself. Her diet was the overflowing of her own gall. Her spleen was so large, as to stand prominent, like a dug of the first rate, nor wanted excrescences in form of teats, at which a crew of ugly monsters were greedily sucking, and, what is wonderful to conceive, the bulk of spleen increased faster than the sucking could diminish it. Otis, said Momus, can you sit idly here, while our devout worshippers, the moderns, are this minute entering into a cruel battle, and perhaps now lying under the swords of their enemies, who then hereafter will ever sacrifice, or build altars to our divinities? Haste, therefore, to the British Isle, and, if possible, prevent their destruction, while I make factions among the gods, and gain them over to our party. Momus, having thus delivered himself, stayed not for an answer, but left the goddess to her own resentment. Up she rose in a rage, and, as it is the form on such occasions, began a soliloquy. "Tis I," said she, "who give wisdom to infants and idiots. By me children grow wiser than their parents, by me beaux become politicians, and schoolboys judges of philosophy. By me sophisters debate, and conclude upon the depths of knowledge, and coffee-house wits, instinct by me, can correct an author's style, and display his minute stares, without understanding a syllable of his matter or his language. By me striplings spend their judgment, as they do their estate, before it comes into their hands. It is I who have deposed wit and knowledge from their empire over poetry, and advanced myself in their stead. And shall a few upstart ancients dare to oppose me? But come, my aged parent, and you, my children dear, and thou, my bodious sister, let us ascend my chariot, and haste to assist our devout moderns, who are now sacrificing to us a hecatomb, as I perceive by that grateful smell which from thence reaches my nostrils. The goddess and her train, having mounted the chariot, which was drawn by tame geese, flew over infinite regions, shedding her influence in due places, till at length she arrived at her beloved island of Britain. But in hovering over its metropolis, what blessings did she not let fall upon her seminaries of Gresham and Covent Garden? And now she reached the fatal plain of St. James Library, at what time the two armies were upon the point to engage, where, entering with all her caravan unseen, and landing upon a case of shelves, now desert, but once inhabited by a colony of virtuosos, she stayed a while to observe the posture of both armies. But here the tender cares of a mother began to fill her thoughts and move in her breast. For at the head of a troop of modern bowmen she cast her eyes upon her son Wotton, to whom the fates had assigned a very short thread. Wotton, a young hero, whom an unknown father of mortal race begot by stolen embraces with this goddess. He was the darling of his mother above all her children, and she resolved to go and comfort him. But first, according to the good old custom of deities, she cast about to change her shape, for fear the divinity of her countenance might dazzle his mortal sight, and overcharge the rest of his senses. She therefore gathered up her person into an octavo compass. Her body grew white and arid, and split in pieces with dryness, the thick turned into pasteboard, and the thin into paper, upon which her parents and children artfully strewed a black juice, or decoction of gall and soot, in form of letters. Her head, and voice, and spleen, kept their primitive form, and that which before was a cover of skin did still continue so. In this guise she marched on towards the moderns, indistinguishable in shape and dress from the divine Bentley, Wotton's dearest friend. "Brave Wotton," said the goddess, "why do our troops stand idle here, to spend their present vigor and opportunity of the day? Away, let us haste to the generals, and advise to give the onset immediately." Having spoke thus, she took the ugliest of her monsters, full glutted from her spleen, and flung it invisibly into his mouth, which, flying straight up into his head, squeezed out his eyeballs, gave him a distorted look, and half overturned his brain. Then she privately ordered two of her beloved children, Dullness and Ill Manners, closely to attend his person in all encounters. Having thus accoutred him, she vanished in a mist, and the hero perceived it was the goddess his mother. The destined hour of fate being now arrived, the fight began, whereof, before I dare adventure, to make a particular description, I must, after the example of other authors, petition for 100 tongues, and mouths, and hands, and pens, which would all be too little to perform so immense a work. Say, goddess, that presidest over history, who it was that first advanced in the field of battle? Paracelsus, at the head of his dragoons, observing Galen in the adverse wing, darted his javelin with a mighty force, which the brave ancient received upon his shield, the point breaking in the second fold. Desant, they bore the wounded Aga on their shields to his chariot. Desant. Nonnulla. Then Aristotle, observing Bacon advance with a furious mien, drew his bow to the head, and let fly his arrow, which missed the valiant modern, and went whizzing over his head. But Descartes it hit. The steel point quickly found a defect in his headpiece. It pierced the leather and the pasteboard, and went in at his right eye. The torture of the pain whirled the valiant bowman round till death, like a star of superior influence, drew him into his own vortex engine's hiatus. When Homer appeared at the head of the cavalry, mounted on a furious horse, with difficulty managed by the rider himself, but which no other mortal durst approach, He rode among the enemy's ranks, and bore down all before him. Say, goddess, whom he slew first, and whom he slew last. First, Gondibert advanced against him, clad in heavy armor and mounted on a state sober gelding, not so famed for his speed as his docility in kneeling, whenever his rider would mount or alight. He had made a vow to Pallas that he would never leave the field till he had spoiled Homer of his armor. Madman, who had never once seen the wearer, nor understood his strength. Him Homer overthrew, horse and man, to the ground, there to be trampled and choked in the dirt. Then with a long Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.